Welcome to When Blue Turns Black, a rare and fascinating exploration of true crime. Join former police officer Vonnie T as she reveals intimate details of her career, explores the psychological toll crime can have with others, and shares her own experience with PTSD.
In this episode, I'm going to talk about the job that would be the initial trigger for my journey with post-traumatic stress disorder. But before I get into the job, I just want to talk to you briefly about post-traumatic stress disorder and what it is, the term PTSD. It's been bandied around a lot. Some people tend to use it as an excuse. But pretty much what post-traumatic stress disorder is, it's a disorder which is characterized by failure to recover after experiencing or witnessing a terrifying event. The condition may last months or years, with triggers that can bring back memories of the trauma accompanied by intense emotional and physical reactions. I'll quickly just go on to say as well that when I was initially diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, I was stunned. I thought, my initial reaction was, but I haven't been to Afghanistan, because I thought that you had to be in a war-torn zone, or a war zone, I should say, for you to have that diagnosis at that extreme, terrifying events that our soldiers and everyone go through that are over there, that's what would trigger PTSD. Unbeknownst to me, like I just said to you, it's witnessing an event, a terrifying event, or being a part of a terrifying event. And that affects everyone differently. Through my therapy, I've since realized that it affects sexual assault victims, domestic violence victims, police, well, first responders. There's a lot of people. It just takes an event that you fear, you're fearing for your life, or that you're terrified, and then it draws out this emotional response in you, which is very intense, and then you'll have flashbacks and your life changes. You can't deal with stress. So in my case, it turns out that being a general duties police officer for all of my career, that the overexposure to trauma, not necessarily always being a terrifying event, this trigger job was a terrifying event, but that overexposure to trauma, because you rock up to work in your uniform, you never know what you're going to attend, whether it be a traffic accident, a fatal traffic accident, a sudden death, a wounding, someone's been stabbed. There's a whole range of jobs that you attend that can trigger this initial response. And I suppose what I'm trying to say, that's the cumulative effect. A lot of police officers have that. It's not just one simple event that triggers it. People will turn around and say, oh, what was your trigger event? But I found through my journey that yes, there was an initial event, but there was lots of triggers along the way. And that's why I wanted to talk last episode about the job with Alexis, because it was the one that just, my body was not going to recover after that one, and my brain. So anyway, I'll get into today's job. It's not actually just one job, it's a shift. And I attended two jobs on that day. And I think it's pretty relevant that I speak about both of them, because they're sort of polar opposite sort of jobs. So it was Christmas Eve in the year 2000, so the 24th of December. I was working at Albany Creek Police Station, and I was rostered a shift with one of the male sergeants. Now this sarge, he was a good guy, pretty straight to the point, a hard worker. You didn't dilly-dally when you worked with him. And we'd been working for a little while when we received information to attend a residence in relation to a sudden death. Now, en route to that job, we had a discussion in the car about whose job it was going to be. That's pretty normal between police officers. It helps when you get to the job, it helps the people at the residence or at the job to know who's in control of that job, because they're only having to pretty much speak with one officer. Not that the other one's going to stay quiet, but, it just makes more sense, because then that officer is collating the information. They have one person to speak to pretty much. So you always sort of would sort that sort that out before you got off at the job. So anyway, I said to him, so whose job's this going to be, Sarge? Yours or mine? Thinking, well, I'm the junior officer. I got 18 months in the job. He's a sergeant. So pretty much assured that it's going to be my job. And he turned around and he said, mate, it's your job. I don't do sudden deaths. And I was like, what do you mean you don't do sudden deaths? And he said, well, I don't do them. I'm the sergeant. I'm not doing it. I don't like jobs that you can get emotionally attached to, that people are emotional. I don't deal with people's emotions. That's not the job that I do. So it's your job. And, you know, at the time I was a bit like, okay, righto. All right. I've pretty much figured it was going to be my job anyway, but, you know, it could have been a bit more tactful. Anyway, he's a sergeant. I respect what he's got to say. So we just do it. So I turned up at the job. I went inside the residence and he stayed out at the car. He didn't even come in for the whole job. So what had happened was there was a family, a husband and wife and their daughter. The daughter was probably, I'm pretty sure she was about my age at the time when I attended that job, mid-20s. And they'd all moved down from up north because Dad had a pretty severe heart condition and he was due to have surgery at the Prince Charles Hospital at Chermside, which is a well known for it being a heart hospital. He had gone into cardiac arrest. His wife had been on the phone to Triple O trying to get the ambulance there in a hurry, and so the daughter was performing CPR. It was a hard job because the pair of them understandably were in shock and they were also distressed. While I was taking details at the job, the daughter broke down and was crying, and mum was crying, and I sort of felt that I can't just stand here, you know, I can't just stand here and let them cry and, you know, offer a tissue. That's not good enough. So I hugged them, and when I hugged them, then I felt really bad for them because, you know, it's Christmas Eve. Dad and husband, he was due to have this operation in a few weeks and he didn't make it. They'd moved their whole life down to North Brisbane or Albany Creek so that they could get his life back on track. There was no guarantees that the surgery would have worked or that something might not have happened during surgery, but they'd had that hope. They were looking forward to something and now that hope was gone. And, it was pretty sad because I couldn't imagine how I would feel if that was, you know, my parents and I was in that situation. So thankfully, I shouldn't say thankfully, but it sounds a bit callous, but in this case, there was a certificate forthcoming. So what that means is because the male had been, he'd had a heart condition, he had been regularly in contact with a doctor, he'd been seeing a doctor and a specialist, that I spoke to that doctor and he was willing to give a certificate with a cause of death. So there would have to be no investigation done. So in Queensland, the coroner needs to know by law the official cause of death for everyone who passes away, doesn't matter what from. So in some circumstances, doctors will give that cause of death. And in other circumstances, we then have to prepare a report for the coroner. And in that process, police have to get the undertaker and, you know, get information off the family and then wait for the undertaker and then escort the undertaker to the morgue where later on down the track an autopsy is performed so that the cause of death is known. And then, you know, if it can't be established, well, then it goes to a coronial hearing. So I know that's a bit out of this job, but I was just explaining that thankfully in this case, we didn't have to be there and in their face the whole time because there was a certificate forthcoming. And, you know, the best I could offer them at this point in time was a hug and just some sort of reassurance that, you know, life, that at least he'd be looked after. It wasn't much when you think about it. It's pretty shallow. So the best that we could offer was just not being there for too long. let them grieve in their own way. And, you know, we were there for the time that needed to be, that they needed someone strong to organize for him to go. So I felt like we took some little weight off their shoulders and took a little bit of that responsibility on the day for them, and we were able to provide that. So I was finishing up at that job, and I heard a job come over the radio for us with only crew working at Albany Creek on that day. And it was a Code 2 job. So that means it's lights and sirens. It's obviously a life-threatening job. So I've had to excuse myself and leave. And I've come out the front. The sergeant's pretty much raring to go, waiting for me. And I jumped in the car and off we went. So because we've been given that priority to proceed with the lights and sirens, I hit the light bar. So now I'm going to just do a little bit of explaining about what that means. Is there was back then there was a panel, a white panel that was like affixed to the console area of the vehicle, and like under weather, the AM/FM radio is. And on it, it had all these buttons, and you would press those buttons to turn on the light, the siren, and have the headlights flashing. There was also one button on there that you could press, and it would turn all of them on automatically, or you could just press each button individually, depending on what you needed at the time. So I pressed the all button, and there is a reason why I'm explaining this to you. So press the button, lights and sirens are on, off we go. He's driving, I'm passenger, I'm receiving the information, talking with Brisbane comms about the job. So they detail us to attend another residence in Albany Creek, where a male was behaving in a very aggressive manner. He was in possession of, holding in his hands an axe, a pickaxe, a metal weight bar, and a spade. And what had gone on prior to us attending was he'd been in the backyard. He was off his rocker, like off his tree a bit, and he was having an argument with the neighbours next door and threatening them. The neighbours had retaliated, you know, like just said something back to him. He got very angry. They then realised that he was abusive and aggressive towards them and threatening them. So they've done the runner and gone inside their house. And as they've gone in the house, he's swung the pickaxe. And when he's done that, the top of the pickaxe, the steel part, was loose, and it's come flying off and gone into their backyard and hit their door. So obviously they've called 000. The family members of the aggressive male have seen what's going on because they were all home as well. They've been trying to calm him down, but he was out in the backyard, you know, carrying on and causing a bit of a ruckus. So we had multiple 000 calls to attend that job. So en route, lights and sirens are going, as I said before. The Sarge, we're getting about two streets off, I reckon, and the Sarge turns and says to me, you better turn the siren off. We'll leave everything else going, but turn the siren off because we don't want him knowing that we're this close, you know. We don't want him to hear that we're just about off. So I bend down and I press the siren button, and it doesn't go off. And I thought, oh, well, maybe because I hit the all button, maybe I need to hit the all button again, and then I'll just press the lights to come back on. So I pressed all, nothing. Siren's still going. So then I start panicking, and I'm pressing both buttons, and nothing's working. I shouldn't say nothing's working. Nothing is stopping the siren, and nothing's turning anything off. So by this stage, I'm frantically hitting the buttons. He's screaming at me to turn it off, because, you know, we're almost off the job and this is going to let old mate know that we're there. So, you know, and I'm still looking in the Refidex, telling him which street to turn, and he's like trying to drive through the traffic. It was a bit busy. You know, it was just this so much stress, and I'm yelling at him that I'm pressing every button and it won't go off. I'm even pressing the all button, and I'm trying to show him, but he's concentrating on the traffic. He has to watch where he's going because, you know, we're going pretty quick as well. So anyway, we pull up in the street, we pull up a couple doors down, and he's ropeable at this stage. I'm pretty sure he thought this young idiot doesn't even know what she's doing. But meanwhile, I was like pretty much bashing on each button and it's not turning off. So he stopped the car, he's started pressing the buttons, and he's realized that the siren isn't going off. Nothing's going off. The lights are still going. You could hear the rotators. When you sit in the car, you could hear when the lights were rotating, and that's what I mean by rotators. You could hear it rotating. So we knew that the lights were still on. They made a funny sound. So everything's still on. So he's like so angry by this stage, and rightly so, because, you know, you would turn the siren off a couple streets back. Anyway, he's grabbed this panel that was, you know, nailed on or whatever, screwed on to the console area, and he's just completely ripped it off, just ripped it right off, hoping that there'd be a button or we could pull the wires out at the back or we could disconnect it somehow. No, and we're trying to pull the wire, like pull it really hard so that the wires came out, nothing. And this stupid bloody siren just kept going. So we had no other choice. We had to get out and go across the road. By this stage, the residents of the house had come out and they were waiting for us to get out of the car and come over and speak to them. When we walked over there, we obviously booked off the job, siren still going, walk in the front yard and had a brief conversation with the residents. At this stage, they said, look, he's a Vietnam vet. He's off his medication. We can't keep him, we can't keep him grounded. Like thinking about it now, post-traumatic stress disorder, like, you know, I have a bit of an understanding of what he was going through. At that time, all I knew that he was a Vietnam vet. He was off his medication, and they said he'd been drinking nonstop for the last couple of days at the RSL. They just couldn't get him to see reason. He just, like, his mental health was just declining, and it had declined so bad that all the family members were at the house and none of them could settle him down. So the last thing that they said was, you're going to need to get your guns out because we don't think that you're going to be able to calm him down. He's very aggressive. And, you know, they described what he'd been doing and that he still had the pickaxe handle and the spade and the weightlifting bar and the axe in his hands. So he's quite a strong man as well to be able to hold all of those things. So the house is a two-story house. And it had, underneath was all enclosed, but you could walk through the front door and then it was like a hallway through and come out in the same line with a doorway at the back. And when you came through the back there was all like a deck area, or not a deck, a concrete area that was undercover. And to the left, there was a set of stairs and there was, that led up to the house, and there must have been maybe a bit of a renovation up there because the part of the house came out a bit further there. And then to the right of that doorway, just over a couple of meters, there was a huge big picnic table, a big timber, like solid timber picnic table. They must have all gathered there for their barbecues, and it was just a really good outdoor entertainment area, pretty much, quite big. And past that area where the concrete finished was it was like the backyard and it was all grass. I can't recall exactly, but I do remember there being some sort of garden shed, or a shed, because you couldn't see the whole way at the backyard, and there was shrubs and, you know, plants and a bit of greenery there, and there was also a clothesline. So at first I could hear him carrying on, but I couldn't quite see him. I could only just sort of see like his hairline. And then been alerted to the fact that we're there. He's come around the trees or the shrubs, and he's walked toward, like started coming towards us. And he was very aggressive. He starts waving the axe and everything around. We immediately triangulate, which means the sarge went to the left, I went to the right, and we kept the male, or as he was walking towards us, we kept him towards in the middle of both of us, so that, you know, if one of us has to shoot, we're not in the same area, or if he comes at one of us, there's another officer there who isn't injured or hurt to help or to stop the threat. So, and that's just common practice. That's what police do. So anyway, we've done the triangulation, got our firearms trained on him, and at this stage, the sarge started calling, you know, drop your weapon, police, we'll shoot. and these commands were repeatedly yelled to the male. He did drop the spade and I think it was the pickaxe handle, but he's still waving the axe and he's got the weight bar and he's carrying on and he's yelling at us. I'll also say at this point in time that I couldn't recall the exact words of what he said. Apparently that's quite common. I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that that stupid siren was still going the whole time. It was just in the background and it was loud and it was just obnoxious and annoying. So it was going off and he's yelling and not listening to what we're saying and still advancing towards us. So we sort of start walking backwards. The Sarge said later on he couldn't recall the exact wording of what the male offender was saying as well. So, you know, I don't know why that was for both of us. Anyway, the male starts advancing a bit quicker towards us and at this stage he's waving the axe around. We've taken several steps backwards and we're pretty much in line with each other. I've taken a look over to the left and seen that the Sarge has got cover if he needs. He can either go through the doorway, go up the stairs, and there was a little bit of room round to the left. I became very aware that I was trapped. So where I was walking backwards, the wall was not far from behind me, and then to my right was the picnic table. And I'm only 5'2", so the odds of me getting up and over that picnic table while he comes at me with an axe is pretty small. I started to realize that I've got myself in a really bad spot here and I've got no cover. So the thing for me is that the Sarge was calling the commands. The Sarge was a tall, strong, assertive man and he took control of the situation, which is what you want. You need one person to give the commands so that they're focused on them. And then that also allows the other officer to cover or to come in and help make the arrest or, you know, grab the offender in certain situations. In this situation, not going to happen because he's got an axe and he's swinging it around. But for me, I knew that the male offender knew I was there, but he wasn't responding to me and he wasn't focused on me. He was responding to the Sarge, which, like I just said, is what you want. However, I'm now stuck in a spot where I've got nowhere to go. And I started thinking, oh, fuck, I'm going to have to shoot him because Sarge hasn't shot him yet. He's still giving him these commands, but this guy's gotten way too close. He's like, all he had to do was rush and then swing or throw that axe at me. And I don't know what would have happened. I honestly had nowhere to go. So I was packing it by this stage. I didn't actually shit my pants, but I felt like I was going to. I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't run even if I wanted to. I had nowhere to go. So the other thing for me is not only am I cornered, but I knew his family was standing upstairs. I could pretty much see them out of my peripheral on the left side of me. They were there watching. And, you know, I'm thinking if I shoot him and they've seen that he wasn't really focused on me, like, what does that mean for me? Does that mean that I'm justified or authorized? Like, I know I was scared and fearful for my life and, you know, all these things were running through my head, but I was like, Sarge, just shoot him. You've got to shoot him. He's too close. It was so scary. I'd never been so scared in all my life. I had all of these stupid thoughts running through my head, like the CJC, am I authorized and justified? Like, am I able to shoot him? I'd been at the academy only, you know, in the last 18 months prior, and they drilled it into our heads that you don't shoot unless you absolutely have to, you know, and this didn't feel like I was at an armed robbery where they're, you know, running out of the bank with their guns blazing and that sort of stuff. It just seems surreal. You know, I didn't know what to do, but at the same token, I was like, this is it. It's if he swings that axe at me, I'm done. There's no coming back. And just as that thought went through my mind, the Sarge warned him once more, drop the weapons or I'll shoot. And he didn't drop. So next minute, No, not next minute, next second, bang. And it was the loudest sound. Like my ears were ringing. It was that loud. It shocked me. It shocked me for a second that I just stood there and watched. I couldn't move. And I saw it. I saw the bullet hit the male and he's gone down. It's hit him in the hip area and he's just gone straight down. He's just hit the ground. And you know, the weights bar fell out of his hand and the axe was like, it fell beside him. But he's still grabbing at them and he's still trying to swing them around at us. You know, it was like it maimed him and he couldn't move his legs, but the top half of him was still going and he's still thrashing around. So at this stage, I take the opportunity to run around the other side of the picnic table and I train my gun back on him and I'm like screaming at him, drop the weapon, drop the weapon. And he just wouldn't drop it. And the son came downstairs and gave us a hand to try and take to move the metal weights bar and to take the axe off him. We managed to get it away from him and, you know, move it pretty far away where he couldn't get to. And at this time, the Sarge has gone and got a towel off the clothesline and was pressing it on the offender's hip. And he was trying to stop the blood, like the flow of blood. And I used this opportunity to call Brisbane Comms. I advised them that the male offender had been shot, that we urgently need ambulance, and we also needed backup. And I was giving them some information over the radio. I was very, like, it was hard. It was hard to talk to them because I didn't have the radio up on, like, the receiver wasn't on my shoulder. I had one that was on my hip, so I had to physically take it off my belt, hold it up. It was really scratchy and, you know, they were having trouble hearing me. I'm having trouble hearing everything that's coming back. I've had to turn it up full bore. And it was just the stress of the whole situation. You know, I've got that adrenaline pumping through me and it was hard to communicate with them. I was trying to give them as much information as I possibly could, and I looked over, and at this point in time, the Sarge was holding the towel on the male offender's hip, and old mate just starts swinging at him, like full-on punches towards the Sarge's head, and I'm just like, through the radio, I actually left it on the ground, and I went and jumped on the male offender and had to grab his hands and his arms and physically restrain the top part of him while the Sarge is holding this, you know, this blood-soaked towel. And the young fellow was trying to help us and he was trying to talk his dad down, but obviously he didn't want to get in the way of us either. And, you know, I'm pretty sure he went and got another towel. And it was just one of the hardest and most stressful jobs I've ever been in. That friggin' siren was still going at this point in time. I can't hear everything that's going on. And I just want someone to come and take us away from there. You know, I just want it ended. I wanted it fixed. I could feel that, you know, the adrenaline dump that I'd had, that strength was like starting to wear off. And I didn't know how much longer I was going to be able to stay on this offender. It was very hard to try and handcuff him at this point in time. He's quite strong and, you know, there was just a bit of a scuffle going on between us. And I managed to just lay my body across him so he couldn't move his arms. And that was about the best I could do at that point in time. And I had, while this was all going on, I had heard Brisbane Comms repeatedly calling me, and then obviously because I couldn't get any response because I didn't have the radio on me. I couldn't put it back on my belt. I was in a hurry to go over and help. So it's just the way it was. I heard them calling code one to all units to proceed there. So code one means that every unit can go lights and sirens, every unit in the area. Whereas code two is still lights and sirens, but it means that only one unit can go and all the other units have to go as per normal. So that allowed for anyone who was close by or anyone just to come, just to help us. And it felt like we were in this position for a whole eternity. And all I wanted was the siren to just stop. Not long after that, one of the dog squad officers came in and I knew him. I knew him quite well and I could just feel myself getting really emotional. And he came over and helped us to restrain the male offender. And The first thing that both of us said to him was, turn that effing siren off. Like, seriously, because he was like, what's the go? Like, what's going on with this siren? So he's gone back out to the car and he's eventually switched it off, and I felt immediate relief when it went off. Turns out he had to put the bonnet up and he cut the wires. I don't know why this happened on this day and why it happened this way. It's never happened to me ever again, and it never happened to me prior to that. So I don't know, there was some malfunction and I've got no idea why, but all I can say now is that it changed the way that that job went. I probably wouldn't have been in that situation, because we would have waited and waited for other police to turn up, and we would have all formulated some sort of plan and we would have gone in. The way it happened, we didn't have a chance. We had, you couldn't just stand there and have a talk about it, because this guy was very aggressive and he was going off. So, you know, we just had to make the best with the circumstances that we were given. It's unfortunate that a stupid bloody siren in a car was the deciding factor on how that job played out. So anyway, QAS were in attendance, and the male offender was eventually escorted while he was taken off with them. And other officers attended, and I never saw that male offender ever again. He went to hospital and was in police custody while he was there. I sort of, by this stage, the more coppers that were turning up, the more familiar faces, because I'd been working at Boondall, you know, and Sandgate. I knew a lot of officers on the north side. So the more familiar faces that came in, the more emotional I got. I remember walking out the front and I hugged one of the officers and I just started crying, and I couldn't stop. It just, I think it was like a release that I was okay, and it was also a release that the Sarge was okay and that we got through that. And I don't know how the hell we did. And, you know, everyone would say, oh, well, that's your training kicking in. But when you're in a situation like that, you can talk about it all you like prior. You could say, oh, this is what I do, this is what I do. But when you're actually in that situation and you have to decide to stay and fight or to run, it's pretty massive. And when you're so scared, and, you know, like, I'm a female, for me, not so bad, because I've got two older brothers. I grew up, you know, mucking around with them and trying to keep up with them. So, you know, I always expected in the job that there'd be physical altercations, and at some stage I would get hurt, and that's okay. But so long as, you know, if you're getting hurt, your partner's getting hurt, you know, you're in it together. But a lot of females aren't used to confrontation and like of a physical nature, and it doesn't come natural to us to stand our ground. It comes natural to run. But, you know, I was actually super proud of myself on that day that I didn't run. There's a little story from one of my sergeants back at the academy who taught me and gave me a lot of advice at the academy. And he had turned up to a job where it was the same sort of thing. Police would say suicide by police, where, you know, the offender had come at the Sarge and his partner with a samurai sword, wanting them to kill him because he was off his chops and he was suicidal, but for whatever reason wasn't taking his own life. So, you know, if I do that, and if you behave like that and then the coppers turn up, they've got no option but to shoot you. Now, the Sarge told me that, told all of us girls actually, that on that occasion, the female officer that he was working with ran back out the front and locked herself in the police car because she was scared. You know, it's not for me to judge her. It's a really scary thing and you don't know how you're going to react. But I was just really glad that he'd told us that story, because it was in the back of my mind. You cannot leave. I don't care how scared you are. You cannot leave. You know, no one's going to work with you ever again. You're not trustworthy. You're not reliable. And you signed up to do this job. So, you know, if it goes bad, it goes bad for both of you. So I was very thankful that he'd, you know, I could hear him in the back of my mind. You've got to say, you can't run, you can't run. It wasn't an option. So after that, I went back to the station and spoke with the boss briefly. I had to be the shooting had to be investigated. Any critical incident like that with involving police has to be investigated. Back then it was the CJC. Those people that were in my mind when I was deciding, do I shoot or don't I? You know, when I had that dilemma going on, is it lawful? You know, am I going to be scrutinized by them? Am I going to end up going to court for this? Am I going to be the one who's charged? Well, they were the ones that came out. There's detectives from there. I think they call it Ethical Support Command now. They came out and interviewed us. And, you know, some of the questions they asked were just like the whole thing confused me because these, I felt that they were just contradictory and stupid questions. I know they got a job to do and I know that obviously there was a reason why they asked. Maybe I was also in shock. I didn't want to say the wrong thing. I didn't want to get the sergeant in any trouble, but at the same token, I'm like, well, I've just got to tell the truth. What happened is what happened. I mean, it's me, the sarge. There's other people watching it. It's not like I can try and make up a story. I've just got to tell him what happened and what story would I make up anyway. But, you know, they asked me things like, were you equipped with OC spray, which is your capsicum spray? Yes, I was. Did you deploy it? No. Why didn't you deploy it? Because he's coming at me with an axe and I don't think spraying him with OC spray is going to exactly stop him. You know, I knew the OC spray, it takes how long for it to kick in anyway. By that time, he's like hacked my head off with this axe. So I was like, no, that's not an option. Axe means firearm every single time. I wouldn't even think of the other accoutrements that I had on my belt. And anyway, that was all fine. They asked this other question that's always stuck in my mind. And they said to me, did you discharge your firearm? And I said, no. And they said, why not? And I said, well, I was pretty scared for my life. And I was at a point where I was about to, but you know, I didn't know. I didn't know if I could. And I didn't know. So, and I said, I really wanted to, and maybe given another couple of seconds, I would have because I had to. Because he was just getting way too close and it was just getting too scary. And I said, but no, I didn't discharge it. And I was like, why? Like, it's almost like you're questioning me that I should be discharging it. And they said, well, they went into some story about studies show that when one officer fires, that the other one, it automatically, sometimes it triggers them to fire as well. So, and I just said, no, my training came into play and you know, I'm not long out of the academy, I suppose. All that stuff was going in my mind. I was just like, I don't know. I just did what I did. It just felt weird. Like I knew I was going to be grilled, but I didn't know why there was these opposing questions and what they were getting at. Anyway, after that, I went back into the boss's office and had a chat with him and they had the police chaplain there. So back in those days, it's coming on 20 years now. Back in those days, the idea of a debrief or, you know, worrying about your mental health, and I'm not going to be critical of the QPS here because I'm sure they were doing the best that they could, but it was a police chaplain telling me how I should feel. Now, I got my back up and I sat there and I thought, I've just been through this fucking scary experience and you're telling me how I should feel. You've never been a police officer and all respect to you, sir, you're a chaplain and I respect that you're a man of faith, but I'm not going to be told how I should feel by someone like you. In fact, I don't even know how I feel. So I just went through the motions with that and then that was pretty much it. That's my debrief. I got rid of my kit and went home and didn't really know how to feel. A while later that night, later in the afternoon, I did receive a phone call from mates that worked at Boondall Station, and some of them were one was a detective, and he said to me, mate, we're almost finished up with this investigation, and that was a pretty shitty job, and we're going to take you out on the piss. So just make sure you're sorted, all right? We're taking you out. So I did, you know, got ready and went out, someone came and picked me up, we went into town and we got blind, rotten drunk. And that's my debrief. And I never really talked about that job much ever again. The odd person would ask me about it, but, and that was it. That's, that's it, you know. Could have lost my life, but that's it. Didn't really know how to tell too many people about it because if you're not a cop, you don't quite understand. It was really kind of surreal. I didn't quite know how to feel. Even in the days after that, I still felt numb. Like on Christmas Eve, I actually received a phone call from the police commissioner and he said to me, he knew that I was rostered to work the next day and on Boxing Day. And he said, I don't want you at work. I think it's appropriate that you take some time off. Like that's a pretty major event to go to, major for you. And he said, you know, it's just, you just shouldn't be at work. But me being me, I was like, well, I grew up on a farm and, you know, we rode horses and that sort of stuff. And if you fell off the horse, you had to get back on. So I was like, no, it's okay. So I can go back to work. I'll be fine. And he said, no, I will not have it. You will not be at work. I will make all the arrangements for staff to cover you. No one will say anything. It's fine. You take the time off. And I was very thankful for that because I got to spend time with my family and I didn't have to be back at work straight away. But I suppose I didn't exactly deal with it. I didn't talk with anyone about it, really. And, you know, it was really surreal being at Christmas lunch and 24 hours prior, like I'd been standing there with my firearm thinking I'm going to have to shoot someone, you know, and someone did get shot in front of me. So it was just surreal. And like I said, just numb. It doesn't really correlate, you know, with being at Christmas lunch. It's something that you can't really talk about unless you're talking to other coppers. And even then, you know, sometimes there's a fear of judgment that they're going to say, well, you should have done this or you should have done that. Or, you know, they might think you're weak or I don't know. You just don't, for all those reasons, you just don't talk about things. So, I never really spoke about it too much, except that like 2.5 years later, I was awarded with a Valor Medal. And this was at an induction parade for new recruits who were graduating from the academy. And yeah, it was a pretty awesome day for me because I was very proud of myself and it reminded me that I did do the right thing on that day. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a Valor Award. It's not just a Valor Award, it's an award, but I didn't even really wear that throughout my service because I copped a bit of a ribbon from people about it. So I was never really, I've always been proud of it myself, but anyway, it's, I've still got it and I've got some other medals, my 10, 15 and 20 year, and they're all going to be put in a special like frame. And I'm going to give them to my daughter. So one day she can look back over my service and say that she's proud of what her mother did.
Thank you for listening to When Blue Turns Black. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review, which helps others find the podcast. And subscribe for future episodes. For more information on Vonnie and her journey, visit VonnieT-TheResilientWoman.com.